This is Audible.
Quiet Strength, The Principles, Practices, and Priorities of a Winning Life by Tony Dungy with Nathan Whitaker. Published by Tyndale House Publishers, Carroll Stream, Illinois. This is Tony Dungy reading. Introduction. Absolutely not. I've been approached many times over the last few years about writing a book, and my answer had always been the same. In 2004, I had lunch with my good friend Nathan Whitaker in Indianapolis, and we talked about doing a book that would be more about life than about football. Could I see how such a book would help others? Yes. But still, my answer was no. And then my team, the Indianapolis Colts, won Super Bowl 41 in February of 2007. Still no. But then the cards and letters and emails started to roll in. Thank you for your witness before the game. My son and I watched your comments after the game together. I could take him to church 20 times, and it wouldn't have opened up a chance for us to talk the way watching that Super Bowl did. My husband moved out 3 weeks ago, but heard one of your comments about putting your family first. He's since called, and he wants to come talk. I like the saying, life is hard, but God is good. It's because of God's goodness that we can have hope, both for here and the hereafter. And it's the desire to share that hope that finally changed my no to a yes. But before we begin, I want to make sure that we're starting at the same place. The point of this book is not the Super Bowl. In fact, it's not football. Don't get me wrong, football is great. It's provided a living and a passion for me for decades. It was the first job I ever had that actually got me excited heading to work. But football is just a game. It's not family. It's not a way of life. It doesn't provide any sort of intrinsic meaning. It's just football. It lasts for 3 hours, and when the game's over, it's over. And frankly, as you'll see throughout this book, that fact that when it's over, is part of football's biggest appeal to me. When a game ends, win or lose, it's time to prepare for the next one. The coaches and players really don't have any time to celebrate or to stay down because Sunday's gone and Monday's here. And no matter what happened yesterday, you have to be ready to play next Sunday. That's how it works, just like life. I'm still not totally comfortable putting my story in a book, but here's how I see it. Although football has been a part of my life that I've really enjoyed, I've always viewed it as a means to do something more, a means to share my faith, to encourage and lift up other people. And I see this book as a way of expanding the platform that football has provided. This book is not only about me either. It's about the priorities, choices, approaches, and habits that lead to being a winner, to experiencing true success. It's about you and me and our journey in this world together. It's about the things I've learned, the mistakes I've made, the heartaches that have made me lean into the Father's presence. I hope that when it's all said and done, you'll see that it's really all about Him. Chapter 1, Tampa Rain. It was time. I figured I'd waited long enough. Darkness had fallen on that winter evening, 2 days after our team's business had concluded for the season. The building was otherwise deserted as I pulled up and parked at the small wooden shack guarding the entrance to One Buccaneer Place. One Buck, as we called it, stood quiet. The one-story stucco and concrete block building was located on the edge of the Tampa International Airport. Oscar, the guard on duty, escorted me through the lock gate on the side of the building. My security code no longer worked. Silently, I gathered 6 years' worth of my professional life from my office. 3-ring binders with notes, play diagrams, and play-calling sheets, various books and photographs, my son's video games, and a couple of Buccaneer hats, although I'd never wear them again. I was lost in my memories as I placed these things rather haphazardly in cardboard boxes, thoughtfully left out for me by my administrative assistant. No, I realized Laura is someone else's administrative assistant now. I stopped to contemplate a wood-framed picture in the stack. It had been taken our first year in Tampa, and we were all beaming. My daughter, Tierra, my sons Jamie and Eric, my wife Lauren, and me. The stadium grass behind us was a vibrant green, the shade of an Irish meadow. sliced into 5-yard increments by crisp white stripes. A teeming throng of humanity, dressed in orange and red and squinting in the unforgiving Florida sun, filled the stands in the picture's background. The summer of 1996 had been a long time ago. Now, in the winter of 2002, that same Florida sky was dark. Dark, cold, and damp. The mist that had begun in the afternoon had turned to light drops. The weather mirrored my dark inner world on that night of January 14th. I finished packing the last of the items. Not that much, really. A few boxes stood by the door ready to be carried home. Nothing else of note remained. That office of mine had been lived in pretty hard, I had to admit. Most of the homework completed by my sons, Jamie and Eric, over the previous 6 years had been done in there, and the office had seen countless games of catch, video game competitions, and other pursuits geared around young boys. As I wrapped things up, I noticed that the light drops falling outside had turned into a heavy rain. I should have just walked out, since by then it was getting late. Instead, I wandered out of my office and through the building, stopping in the coach's locker room. Standing in the middle of the room, I let my gaze sweep over the cramped, worn 12-by-15 room. I looked from locker to locker, reading some of the names, imagining others. Monty Kiffin, Chris Furster, Clyde Christensen, Rod Marinelli. We had shared this locker room in many memories, these men and I. We had spent hours, weeks, and years together. These men had walked off the frozen, concrete-hard synthetic turf in Philadelphia with me just 2 days earlier, their careers critically stung by the Bucks' 31-9 loss. It was a difficult season, punctuated by a painful ending. And now God had something different in mind for all of us. I tried to take solace in the things that we had accomplished together. 3 straight playoff appearances, more wins than any other staff in team history, but they seemed hollow, even within me. I stared at the lockers, the enormity of the moment suddenly overwhelming as I remembered names of guys long gone from my staff. Lovie Smith, Herm Edwards, Mike Shula. The prognosticators had been circling for weeks, and amid season-long rumors that a new head coach was being courted, their speculations had finally become reality. I had been fired. My family had come to Tampa for a reason. God had led us here, opened doors that we didn't expect would be open, and allowed us to connect deeply with this community. But for what purpose? Not football, apparently. I felt certain that the Buccaneers were my best and possibly last chance to lead an NFL team. For whatever reason, God had closed the door. For what? It wasn't really the firing itself that was a shock, but rather the thought that God was allowing this great experiment to end. Hadn't we tried to do things right? Oscar reappeared. It was late, approaching midnight. I walked out, traversing a path between the squat racks, benches, and other weightlifting machines in the weight area attached to the building. A cool mist blew in under the awning, dampening my 46-year-old face. I looked to my left, past the row of squat racks and away from the building. Through the dark and rain, I could barely make out 2 shadowy practice fields. The runway lights of the airport were clearly visible just yards beyond. Where was the burning bush? Where was that still small voice? Or even better, the loud booming one? The only voice I could hear clearly was my own, crying out in the wilderness, "When will I hear your voice, Lord?" I returned from my thoughts as Oscar quickly maneuvered between and around the weight machines to beat me to the next door. He pressed the electronic pad, releasing the magnetic lock on the chain-link gate that separated the weight area and the practice fields from the waiting parking lot. The Bay News 9 reporter had been waiting all night for this shot. For 2 days, news trucks had been parked along the street, on the front lawn, in the surrounding ditches, wherever they could fit, close to one buck. I thought everyone had abandoned the vigil hours earlier when the Buccaneers had issued a statement there would be a press conference the following morning. But on a hunch, this reporter had doubled back in the dark and rain, and he was about to hit the jackpot. He must have seen my head over the dark green screen of the fence. He began filming just as I carried the boxes through the gate and into the open area. He was across the street, sitting in the back of a news van on airport property, but given the narrow street and the small parking area, he was no more than 50 feet away. The lens on his video camera more than compensated for that short distance as I walked directly toward him. His nighttime footage of me would air repeatedly over the next several days. Everyone in the Tampa viewing area would have multiple opportunities to see Tony Dungy, former head coach of the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, placing boxes into his SUV in the pouring rain. When will I hear your voice, Lord? Soon, I hope. I knew everything would ultimately be fine, but at that moment, on that rain-swept night of January 14, 2002, my explorer and my spirits traveled under the same dark clouds. Chapter 2. Growing Up a Dungy. Growing up in Jackson, to my way of thinking, was the way growing up was meant to be. Jackson is a small town in Michigan, about an hour from Detroit and 25 minutes from East Lansing. In addition to being my birthplace, it lays claim to being the site of the first official meeting of the Republican Party, brought together by the group's common opposition to slavery, and for years it housed the largest wall prison in the world. If those three items are linked, I haven't yet figured out how. Most of the jobs in Jackson revolved around the auto industry. Guys played high school sports, got out of school, and went to work at one of the big factories. They'd buy a car and get married. That's the way most of the guys I knew approached life. But because of our parents, we Dungy kids never thought that way. Both my parents were college graduates, and it was always assumed that my siblings and I would go to college. Our parents talked regularly about what we wanted to do and their visions of what we could do. More than anything, my mom and dad focused on exercising our brains, building both knowledge and character. Herm Edwards, a longtime friend and now head coach of the Kansas City Chiefs, is always quick to remind me that, of all the Dungy children, I'm the one who's a football coach. I'm pretty sure he means that in a bad way. All three of my siblings are in professions dedicated to serving others. Sherry is a nurse at the Southern Michigan Correctional Facility near Jackson, devoting her life to inmate care. Lyndon is a dentist and recently opened his own dental practice. His dream has always been to give care to people who otherwise might not be able to afford it. Lauren, Lyndon's twin, is a perinatologist. She deals with high-risk pregnancies in Indianapolis and throughout Indiana. All three are exceptional at what they do. My line of work gives me more notoriety in some circles, but they're all doing things that are much more important in the long run. The three of them are definitely a living tribute to our parents and their values. Our home was a small green two-story house with wood siding and a dirt backyard. Any grass bold enough to try to come up would instantly be trampled by all the neighborhood kids and my mom playing whatever game was in season. I was in seventh grade before I beat my mom in a foot race. She and I often raced the 60 or 70 yards around the house. But until that memorable day in junior high, I had never once beaten her. Cleo Mae Dungy was tall, athletic, energetic, and quick to laugh. But even as I remember that, my mind also sees her late in life, shrunken and withered in a wheelchair from years of battling the diabetes that ultimately took her life in 2002. My mom was born in Amherstburg, Ontario, and she played on Canadian junior basketball teams as a young girl. She carried the title of most athletic Dungy throughout most of her life. Between her love of basketball and serving as advisor to the cheerleading squad at Jackson High, she made sure we Dungy kids were exposed to all kinds of sports. In contrast, my father was more interested in individual sports. I think he was motivated by the desire to continually measure his progress and by the idea that he could improve by an act of will. As a boy, my dad participated in boxing and track and field. Throughout his adulthood, he still followed both regularly. Team sports, from his perspective, existed primarily for the life lessons they could teach his children. My mom always insisted on teaching at least one elective section of English or public speaking. She believed that many of the kids in Jackson decided far too early in life to finish high school, then immediately get a job at the glassworks, the metal shop, or the prison. My mom was concerned, almost fanatical, about making sure her students saw the many different opportunities the world held before deciding to end their education. She used Shakespeare and anything else at her disposal to do it. One student who took an elective from her has called me many times through the years. He had spent his entire childhood in the special education track of the Jackson schools. Although in special ed, he was able to take public speaking as an elective. Somehow, early in the semester, my mom realized this student had been mislabeled as a special ed kid. My mom wouldn't rest until she got his counselor to place him in regular classes. Once he was reassigned, this student began to blossom, and eventually he went on to attend and graduate from Western Michigan University. He gives my mom complete credit for the career he has today. A life changed. My dad was usually a quiet, thoughtful man, a scientist at heart and by training. Wilbur Dungy loved to be outside, enjoying the scenery. Fishing allowed him time to contemplate, to listen, and to marvel at God's creation. My dad used fishing to teach his children to appreciate the everyday wonders of the natural world God created, the sandy shoreline, the dark pine forest, the shimmering water, and the abundant wildlife. The lessons were always memorable, whether we caught a lot of fish or not. Although we fished countless times together throughout our lives, one particular day stands out in my mind. It was a summer day in 1965. I was 9 years old and my brother was six. My dad had taken us fishing at one of the many small lakes around Jackson. On that day, my dad was teaching my brother and me how to cast. We were both working on it, mostly in silence, until my dad's voice finally broke a period of stillness. "Hey, Lyndon, don't move for a minute, please." I looked back and watched my dad move his hand toward his face. Calm and deliberate, he continued to speak. "Now, Lyndon, always make sure that you know not only where your pole is while you're starting to cast." At this point, I realized my dad was working my brother's hook out of his own ear. "But also make certain that you know where everyone else is around you." I learned something about proper casting that day, but I also learned something about patience. Years later, when I got hooked myself in my hand, I realized how much it hurts. Remembering my dad's patience that day when Lyndon's hook was caught in his ear, I finally understood the importance of staying calm and communicating clearly. Although my dad always considered the University of Michigan his alma mater, the 3 years we spent at Michigan State when I was in elementary school, while my mom and dad earned their advanced degrees, had a dramatic impact on me. We were there from 1963 to 1966, and while I vividly remember looking at microscope slides with my dad, I remember being just as enthralled by Duffy Doherty's Spartan football teams. Those Michigan State teams ultimately altered the trajectory of my life in an unexpected way. We moved back to Jackson in 1966 after my dad's graduation, and he resumed teaching full-time. His goal was to provide students who needed to start at Jackson Community College the same eye-opening college experience that he had enjoyed. Like my mom, he focused on squeezing every bit of potential from his students, especially those who were struggling. My mom and dad were a perfectly matched set. It's hard to overestimate the importance of the lessons my parents taught me, lessons that have molded and shaped me. The necessity of persistence, the value of education, the fun of athletics, and the importance of living up to your potential. However, there's one gift they bestowed that I'd place above all the others. Faith. My grandfather on my dad's side was a minister who occasionally taught courses at Detroit Bible College. Two of my father's brothers became ministers as well. My mother's side of the family also gave me plenty of godly heritage. Her parents were God-fearing people of high integrity who died before I was 10. My mother was a phenomenal storyteller, and from her I learned the importance of illustrating a lesson with a word picture. She taught Sunday school every week, and usually, as with her Jackson High lessons, she practiced her Sunday school lessons on us Thursday or Friday night. I knew a ton of Bible stories before I could even read a Bible, a rich heritage. As far back as I can remember, I understood who Jesus was, that he died because of the things I had done wrong, and that I could go to heaven if I asked him into my life. I'm guessing I was about 5 when I first learned that. Despite the Christian lifestyle my parents modeled for me, a real understanding of what it means to make Jesus the Lord of my life, number one in my life, wouldn't hit home until many years later when I was in the NFL in Pittsburgh. I can't place a value on the lessons I learned and on the faith my parents imparted day after day after day. Actually, I can. The value is eternal. Chapter 3, A Black Quarterback. I wanted to be a Spartan. My dad may have been a Wolverine when he was an undergrad, but after my parents finished earning their graduate degrees in East Lansing, I returned to Jackson, a huge Michigan State fan. Both as a sophomore and as a junior, I started at quarterback on the Parkside High School varsity football team, and I had very good seasons both years. As a team, we were fairly good, although when I was in 10th grade, we lost our last game of the year to Jackson High School, my mom's school. We remedied that loss by beating them my junior year. Although basketball was my favorite sport, and I hadn't given much thought to playing football in college, it wasn't out of the question. And if I ever did play in college, I knew it would be for Duffy Doherty at Michigan State. But then, following our win against Jackson at the end of my junior season, I quit the high school football team. I was 17 years old and pretty sure I knew more than my high school football coach, and I was prepared to take a stand. Leroy Rockamore was an African-American administrator at our predominantly white junior high. Although he took a personal interest in all the kids, he seemed to pay special attention to the African-American boys. He wanted to make sure that we grew as people, not just as athletes. He often took us to basketball games and to movies, or sometimes he simply had lunch with us. Many times he brought us into his office to talk about things other than school. In short, he cared. One of my closest buddies was Bobby Burton, a receiver. The two of us had been starters on the varsity team since our sophomore season and were the leading offensive players on the team. We had just finished the football season of our junior year at Parkside, and it had been a pretty good year all in all. Our coach Dave Driscoll's policy was for the team to vote for the following year's captains at the end of the season. The winners would be announced at the fall sports banquet in November. That year I was elected as a team captain. Bobby wasn't. I just couldn't understand this. It seemed obvious to me that both of us should have been the captains. I could only think of one explanation. For some reason, the school didn't want to have two black captains. It seems impossible now, but at the time it didn't. Parkside's football team had never had two black captains, and no one could convince me that those votes had been counted correctly. I was hurt and felt certain that a race-based injustice had been done. Reacting to the hurt I felt for Bobby, as well as for myself and for all the black players, I quit the team. Of course, I was a fairly good player, a popular student, a newly elected captain, and a quarterback, so the other African-American players decided they were going to quit the football team, too. I hadn't really thought about that possibility when I decided I wasn't going to play, but it didn't bother me at the time. I figured everybody had to make his own decision. The player walkout began after the postseason banquet in November and continued through the rest of the school year. At the end of the summer, when the team was preparing to go back to practice, Mr. Rockamore invited me to his house. He had already talked to me a couple of times about my decision to quit football, but I think he wanted to give me one more chance to reconsider. "Tony, you enjoy playing football, and these other guys enjoy playing football. You should have your senior year to play, and so should they. At the end of the day, what are you really upset about anyway?" I began to answer, but he continued, talking over me without waiting for a response. I hadn't realized his question was rhetorical. "Even if the issues are important, should they spoil the fun that all of you should be having playing football as seniors? 30 years from now, you don't want to look back and say that you missed out on something you really loved doing." Then he asked the question he really wanted me to answer. "Why would you let anything stop you from doing what you have the ability to do?" Although by then I was convinced he was right, I'd always had quite a temper, and my pride just wouldn't allow me to back down. Practically speaking, I could understand Mr. Rockamore's point, but from a moral standpoint, I was still pretty sure I was in the right. Plus, at 17, and even at 51, pride and hurt feelings can be pretty overwhelming emotions. After he spoke with Coach Driscoll, Mr. Rockamore arranged for the three of us to meet. Coach was a very principled guy, and he set the tone for the meeting. "Tony, you can come back, but you've missed winter conditioning, you've missed our summer workouts, so you guys," he knew if I came back, the others would also come back, "are going to have to do some extra stuff to earn your way back." He mentioned extra running, washing the dishes at camp, and so forth as his requirements, "if I'm going to let you back." When he had finished, I think the only thing I heard was, "if I'm going to let you back." I was getting mad thinking, if he's going to let me back? I started to get visibly upset, and Mr. Rockamore gave me a look that kept me quiet and in my seat. After the meeting, he took me aside and said, "Coach is the coach, and you're the player, and there are times in life when you're going to have to do certain things. That's just how it goes. That's a lesson you're going to have to learn to get through life." In the end, we all went back and worked our way back onto the team. It was a great year. We lost only one game, the de facto state championship game. They didn't have playoffs in those days. Even more important, today I have a great relationship with Coach Driscoll. In fact, he came to Super Bowl 41 to see me, and we shared an emotional hug at our Saturday practice before the game. I see now what I couldn't see as a strong-willed teenager, thanks to the firm hand of Coach Driscoll and the gentle guidance of Mr. Rockamore. If Mr. Rockamore hadn't taken that interest in me, not merely as an athlete and a student, but as a friend, everything would have been different for me. Something got in the way of my vision of playing football for Duffy Doherty at Michigan State. He retired, but his retirement opened up a number of possibilities in my mind. I considered playing basketball at Duke or Arizona, where my friend Bob Elliott was headed. I also thought about the University of Southern California for football. I had gotten to know a number of players on recruiting trips, including Gary Jeter, a high school All-American from Ohio. Wayne Fonts, who was then a USC assistant coach as well as their national recruiter, invited me, along with Gary Jeter and Marvin Powell, another future star, to spend a weekend at Southern Cal. Meanwhile, another coach had warned me about Southern Cal. "You'll never play quarterback," he said. "Their quarterback lived with the coach. You can't possibly beat him out." I initially chalked this up to negative recruiting, but sure enough, when I did some research, I found that Pat Hayden, USC's sophomore quarterback, had lived with head coach John McKay's family when he was in high school. I scratched USC off my list. Cal Stahl, the second-year head coach at the University of Minnesota, actually presented the most intriguing opportunity for me. Cal had coached the wide receivers at Michigan State under Coach Doherty, and I saw joining his program at Minnesota as the closest thing to playing at Michigan State. Plus, two coaches I really liked, Woody Woodenhofer and Tom Moore, were doggedly recruiting me to Minnesota. Woody Woodenhofer was the best recruiter I had ever seen. He attended almost every one of my basketball games my senior year, and we became lifelong friends. But shortly after I signed with Minnesota, Coach Woodenhofer resigned and joined the Pittsburgh Steelers. Tom Moore stayed at Minnesota as the quarterback's coach, and it was from him that I learned the same offense we run together in Indianapolis today. It was a perfect fit for me and my skills because it allowed me to call much of the game and think while I was out on the field. Coach Cal Stahl at Minnesota was one of the first CEO-type coaches. Most of the coaches I had seen previously, such as Coach Driscoll, coached either the offense or the defense in addition to performing the duties of a head coach. Coach Stahl did not. He wasn't one of those tower-type coaches like Bear Bryant at Alabama, who was far removed from the field. Coach Stahl, like Coach Doherty had done at Michigan State, hired great teachers as his assistants and then gave them the latitude to coach. He set the vision and the direction, motivated the team, and then let the assistant coaches do the coaching. Coach Stahl held a meeting with the freshmen every year. During the course of our meeting, he asked, "Every one of you thinks you're going to play in the NFL, right?" Every head in the room nodded. He pulled out a photograph of the freshman team from 5 years prior. The guys who made it to the NFL were circled. "Him and him," he said, pointing to the picture. "Two of them made it. Out of 32, 33, 35, whatever we've got this year, one of you will go on to play in the NFL. Or, if you're lucky, two. You're going to have to outwork everybody in this room and then catch a break in order to make your living in the NFL. Of course, we each thought we were going to be that one, but I must admit this did make an impression. Coach Stahl went on to talk about our education and preparing for the rest of our lives, lives without football. Since I was just days removed from my parents' home, that message resonated with me. Like most underclassmen, I wanted to fit in. Many of the guys I played football with went out for a few beers at night or went to campus parties, which usually included drugs and alcohol. Throughout high school, I had never known anyone that is, who was an athlete or serious about taking care of his body, who drank, smoked, or took drugs. No one I respected, anyway. That changed at the University of Minnesota. There, guys who were performing at very high levels athletically also drank, smoked, and used various illegal drugs. Some coaches from other sports knew about it and even encouraged players to take their recruits to area bars. What would my mom and dad think always went through my mind whenever I had the opportunity to take a drink or smoke a cigarette. I had been taught that smoking and drinking were not right for us as a family, and illegal drugs, well, they were illegal, therefore they weren't for me. But this was a test because I saw that great athletes could drink and do drugs and get away with it for a while. I still hung out with all the guys and went to parties, but I never did smoke, drink, or take any drugs. And the more I was around those things, the more I understood why my decision was a smart one. When I arrived in Minneapolis in the summer of 1973, I was eager to start learning the no-huddle offense from Coach Tom Moore as soon as possible. I also wanted to familiarize myself with the campus and begin a summer job. The school lined me up with a position at a meatpacking plant called Feinberg's. It was within walking distance from where I was living, about 15 blocks, which was ideal because I didn't have a car. My shift started at 6 a.m., which gave me time in the afternoon to work out and spend time learning the offense with Tom. There were two minor difficulties with the meatpacking job. First, I had never worked so hard in my life, before or since. Second, I always seemed to have stray dogs following me from work to the university's football offices. I didn't feel like I was in danger of being attacked, but it took me about 3 days to figure out what was attracting them. The smell of pastrami. I stuck with that job all summer, remembering what my dad had taught me about learning from every experience. I definitely learned one thing. I never wanted to work in a meatpacking plant again. By my senior year, my reputation as a football player was building, and the jobs were a little easier to find. That summer, I worked in the sporting goods department of Dayton Hudson's flagship department store in downtown Minneapolis. Right before the season started, the Minneapolis Tribune ran a preseason Big Ten section with a story about me, along with my photo. With my huge afro and suit, I looked as if I had just walked off the stage from a Sly and the Family Stone gig. The caption asked, "Would you buy a tennis racket from this man?" Probably a fair question. Wisconsin is a big rival for Minnesota. Even today, Big Ten alums in our Colts locker room laugh about the rivalry games in the conference. It seems that each week the teams are playing for something. If somebody's not handing something over after a game, it just doesn't seem like a Big Ten game. The Minnesota-Wisconsin game is the longest-running rivalry game, dating back to 1890. The winner gets Paul Bunyan's axe. My junior year, we were playing Wisconsin at home in Minneapolis. Wisconsin had trounced us the year before in Madison, and we had some guys from Madison on our team who badly wanted to win. In addition, this was our last game of the year, and we wanted to send the seniors out with a victory. It was an emotional game for us. As we got into the game, we found we could run at will against them. From the opening kickoff, we could just feel that we were going to win. On that opening drive, we took the ball and gashed their defense all the way down the field with our running game. But I knew I only needed one touchdown pass to set a Big Ten record. So on first down and goal from their 7-yard line, I changed the play at the line of scrimmage from a run to a pass. As I was releasing the ball, my arm got hit, and my pass was intercepted in the end zone. When I came off the field, our offensive line coach, Roger French, was there to meet me. "I'm so mad," he shouted at me. "If I had a gun, I'd shoot you right now." I was glad he was unarmed. Coach French later went to Brigham Young University and coordinated some explosive passing offenses. But that day, understandably, he wanted to run the ball. Thankfully, our running back stayed hot, the offensive line controlled the line of scrimmage, and we dominated Wisconsin with the run, winning 24-3. I even threw that touchdown pass to set the record. We were happy to have Wisconsin hand over Paul Bunyan's axe. In the end, I carved out a pretty nice college football career under coaches Stahl and Moore at Minnesota. I graduated as fourth all-time in total offense in the Big Ten, a two-time team most valuable player, and captain my senior year. I was also a two-time academic All-Big Ten, all the while having a blast running our innovative offense. We played Illinois my senior year, and they executed very sophisticated schemes on defense, requiring me to make adjustments during the game. "If you see this alignment, we're getting into this formation," and so on, as Tom Moore had instructed me. We won the game 29-14, and afterward, their head coach, Bob Blackman, congratulated me for the work I'd done orchestrating our offense. That meant a lot to me coming from him because the intricacies of their defense were specifically designed to confuse the quarterback. As a result of my on-field performance in college, there was no doubt in my mind that I would be drafted and go on to a career as a quarterback in the NFL. I had worked out for scouts and coaches from a number of teams, including the Washington Redskins, who said they would be looking for a third quarterback and that I fit the bill. Some friends thought I might go to the Vikings since my style was so similar to that of Fran Tarkenton, their quarterback at the time. I shared a fairly small apartment in Minneapolis with my teammate, wide receiver Mike Jones. Mike was from Detroit Central High School and terrifically talented. Terrell Owens reminds me of Mike, a tall, sleek, fast guy who can run, catch, and jump. Mike had hurt his Achilles tendon our junior year and was never quite the same after the injury, but he was hoping to be drafted as well. Back then, the NFL draft wasn't televised over the weekend. That year, 1977, the draft was held on a Tuesday and Wednesday, and it lasted 12 rounds. Three of the guys Wayne Fonts had recruited to USC 4 years earlier turned out to be just as good as advertised. Ricky Bell went to the Buccaneers as the first pick overall, Marvin Powell went fourth to the New York Jets, and Gary Jeter went fifth to the New York Giants. My only goal was to go somewhere in the remaining 330 picks. Mike and I waited by the phone all day Tuesday, then started our vigil again Wednesday morning. The phone finally rang Wednesday afternoon. The Giants were on the line in the 10th round and wanted to speak with Mike. So Mike was the 255th pick, following our defensive back, George Adzik, who had gone to Seattle in the 9th round. I hope Coach Stahl hadn't been right when he said only two guys would go to the NFL. We celebrated Mike's selection for a while and then turned our attention back to the phone to wait for my call. The phone didn't ring again. That evening, around 8 o'clock, we called a buddy who was with the Associated Press. "Is the draft over?" I asked. "Yeah, it's over," he confirmed. We hung up. Nobody called me. That doesn't seem like a good sign. It wasn't. The phone did ring a short while later, though, as NFL clubs tried to fill out their rosters much as they do today. Starting toward the end of the draft, clubs began to get an idea of the positions they still need to fill for training camp. If they're not able to draft enough players at a position to fill out their roster, the scouts began working the phones, trying to find the highest-rated non-drafted players who might agree to come to camp as free agents. I had a number of opportunities during the course of those telephone calls to play defensive back or wide receiver, but I didn't receive a single offer to play quarterback in the NFL. I was crushed. Chapter 4, Putting God First. I was in shock after not being drafted into the NFL. Something about this didn't seem fair, didn't seem right. I was numb, devastated. I prayed, "God, I can't believe it. Help me figure out what I'm supposed to do now." I did have one opportunity to play quarterback, but it was in Canada. The Montreal Alouettes held my rights in the Canadian Football League, and their coach, Marv Levy, had spoken with me a number of times before the draft. A number of the NFL free agent calls were offering me between $1,000 and $1,500 as a signing bonus. By contrast, Montreal was offering me a bonus of $50,000. However, I'd always had my sights set on the NFL. I wanted to compete against the players I felt were the very best. I was hoping for a divine signal that would make my decision clear, even if it meant signing to play a totally new position. "Lord, I'd really like to play in the NFL, but it doesn't appear to make a whole lot of sense right now. Please help me figure out what to do." I prayed that prayer and others like it repeatedly over the next few days. The Buffalo Bills wanted to play me at free safety. I was ready to head up there when Tom Moore, my college coach, entered the picture again. Tom had left the University of Minnesota after my senior season and joined Woody Woodenhofer as a wide receiver coach with the Pittsburgh Steelers. Tom and Woody had spoken with Steelers head coach Chuck Knoll and told him that I was a bright guy who could fit somewhere within their organization. They didn't need another quarterback. They'd taken Cliff Stout in the 5th round. But Tom told me he was sure I could help the Steelers in some way. I updated him on the Bills situation, letting him know that they were mailing a contract to me the next morning. Tom hopped on a flight and brought the Steelers contract with him, ensuring he'd arrive before the mail. I signed with the Pittsburgh Steelers for a bonus of $2,200, plus another $20,000 in salary if I made the team. I was so excited and sure that was where God wanted me to go, until I started telling my friends, "Are you nuts? What position do you think you're going to play?" The Steelers had just missed going to their third straight Super Bowl in 1976. "You think you're going to play receiver? Ever heard of John Stallworth? Well, he doesn't even start at receiver for them. And eight of their defensive guys, eight of them, just went to the Pro Bowl, plus three guys from the offense. 11 guys in the Pro Bowl. Donnie Shell and Jimmy Allen are backup defensive backs. Where do you think you're going to play? How are you even going to make the team?" "Well, I don't know. I want to play with the best, and these guys are the best." Signing with the Steelers had seemed like the right thing to do immediately after the draft, but I found myself second-guessing my decision for about a week afterward. I was just walking in faith, faith in God and faith in what Tom had told me. "You're a smart guy, so you're going to have chances to make it with us in Pittsburgh somewhere." The more I thought about it, it really didn't seem like a logical decision after all, but I had prayed about it, and joining the Steelers just seemed to be the right thing to do. So I headed off to Pittsburgh with no idea what God had in store for me, either personally or professionally, in that city. It turned out that I was a wide receiver in the NFL for about 2 months. I went through the mini camps and about 2 weeks of training camp. Then, because of some injuries to other players, the Steelers moved me across the line of scrimmage to the defense, at safety. I loved the challenge of learning a new position, and it was great to be in with Mel Blount, Donnie Shell, Jimmy Allen, and the rest of those guys. Fortunately for me, they were all willing to help, and our defensive coordinator, Bud Carson, was a genius. I absorbed everything I could from him. In fact, I was so busy studying and watching game films that the coaches let me borrow a 16mm projector so I could watch them in my room. Unfortunately, the projector somehow interfered with the television reception, causing snow on the veteran players' TV screens. In addition to many great players, that team included some really solid Christians. Because of our physical and rough style of play, we weren't necessarily seen as a group of believers, but even head coach Chuck Knoll, who was a devout Catholic, often used Bible verses to inspire us. When Mark Brunell, Tony Baselli, Kyle Brady, and other Jacksonville Jaguar players were criticized in the late 90s for not being tough enough on the football field because they were Christians, I could only think of our Steeler teams of the 1970s and smile. My crash course in playing safety must have worked because I was still on the team as we headed into the final cuts before the regular season. Some of my success resulted from my efforts to absorb the defensive schemes and by asking questions and watching film on my own, but a good bit of it stemmed from the fact that I bought into Coach Knoll's approach so quickly. At the Steelers minicamp shortly after the draft, I had taken to heart Coach Knoll's words about what it took to win in the National Football League. "Champions don't beat themselves," he told us. "If you want to win, do the ordinary things better than anyone else does, day in and day out. We're not going to fool people or out-scheme them. We're just going to outplay them because we'll know what we're doing. When we get into a critical situation, we won't have to think. We'll play fast and fundamentally sound." Chuck Knoll developed much of his coaching philosophy from the legendary Paul Brown, and I got mine from Chuck. I tell people that I'm from the Paul Brown School of Football. It was the summer of 1977, and I still hadn't made the team. In those days, the relationship of the football clubs and the media was different. Local reporters traveled on the team charter to games. I vividly recall Dwight White, our Pro Bowl defensive end, sitting in the back of the plane, blowing cigar smoke rings while talking with Vito Stellino, one of the Pittsburgh beat writers at the time. Vito always had good information, in part because he was good at what he did, and in part because he sat in the back of the plane with Dwight White. We played our last preseason game on a Friday night and had the weekend off until Monday's team meeting. The last cut would be made on Saturday or Sunday, whenever the coaching staff made their decision. On Saturday morning, I picked up a paper and immediately turned to Vito Stellino's article detailing which guys were going to get cut. My name was on Vito's list. I figured that if the story was in the paper, Vito must have gotten his information from the coaches, Dwight, or some other reliable source. Because I didn't want to be embarrassed by showing up on Monday after I'd been cut, I sat in my hotel room all weekend waiting for the phone to ring to tell me I was no longer on the team. For some reason, that call never came. Monday rolled around. It was a hot, steamy September morning in Pittsburgh. I drove to the facility, sneaking into the back of the locker room so nobody would see me. They had left my stuff in my locker. I was just about to take my personal belongings when I saw my nameplate on my locker. It was still there. Suddenly I realized I've made the team. I played it cool, making sure everything was hung up neatly, acting as if I'd just been doing a bit of rearranging. I don't think Coach Knoll even realizes what an important lesson I learned that weekend. It was an unforgettable and excruciating experience, that entire weekend of sitting and waiting. To this day, I make sure I tell our guys exactly when the cuts are coming, and I try to give them a one-hour time window to stay by their phones. That year, 1977, I had a fair amount of playing time at the safety position, and I ended up intercepting 3 passes for the season. One of those interceptions came in a game that was remarkable, at least from my point of view. Back in May, when I had been anxiously sitting by the phone during the NFL draft, the Steelers had selected a quarterback named Cliff Stout from Youngstown State University in the 5th round. Now, in an October game in Houston, both starting quarterback Terry Bradshaw and backup quarterback Mike Kruzek were knocked out of the game with injuries. Cliff was on the inactive roster that day, so I was brought in at quarterback to finish up the 4th quarter. I played terribly. I fumbled a snap, and Rocky Blyer and I fumbled a handoff. I didn't realize the backs took the ball differently at Pittsburgh than they had done in college. To make matters worse, I threw 2 interceptions near the end of our 27-10 loss. In the process, I became the last player in NFL history to intercept the pass and throw an interception in the same game. I felt awful about my performance because I knew I'd cost us the game. Despite my disappointment, however, I realized that I had done something very few people would ever do. I took snaps from Mike Webster, handed off to Franco Harris, and threw passes to Lynn Swann and John Stallworth, all future Hall of Famers, during a regular season game. If I had practiced with the offense at all, the fumbles wouldn't have occurred. However, I once again began focusing on how I could continue to improve as an NFL safety. Some people had suggested to me that I wasn't drafted as a quarterback because of my race. At first, I didn't agree. I just figured that playing quarterback in the NFL was completely different from playing in college. But after talking with coaches and scouts that first year, I grew less certain. A number of them said they had passed on me in the draft because of quantifiable characteristics such as my height and arm strength. Later in the season, however, when we played guys like Bob Greasy, Joe Ferguson, and Fran Tarkenton, I would deliberately walk by, look them in the eye, and measure my height against theirs. I was as tall as each one of them. I began to wonder if race had indeed played a role. To make matters worse, when I saw the backup quarterbacks, now that was really frustrating. A lot of them just weren't very good, and I continued to wonder. During that week in the middle of the 77 season, I realized that quarterbacking in the NFL was ultimately no different from playing quarterback at any other level. I believe I could have done it given the opportunity, but I didn't get that opportunity, and whether it was because of my race or because of some legitimate factor, it was time to move on. I was heading into the 1978 training camp with a year of playing defense under my belt. I was still watching as much film as possible and absorbing everything I could from Woody Woodenhofer and the players on the defense. Physically and mentally, I knew it was going to be a much better year for me. But then I started dragging a little, feeling a little tired as camp approached. I headed over to camp a couple of days early, and the team doctor checked me out. Mononucleosis. If you had known me and my dating habits back then, you'd know that mono isn't always the kissing disease. I was focused on my career as much as anything, but I was also pretty shy. The doctor told me he would check on me every few days. I would be allowed to take the field when my white blood cell count dropped back to normal levels. I started to improve quickly, but day after day, after day after day, my white blood cell count was still too high. After missing 3 weeks, preseason lasted just about forever back then, I was really frustrated and I was getting difficult to be around. Late one evening in our room, I told Donnie Shell, I don't know that I'm going to make this team. By the time I get back, my conditioning level will be down and there are other new guys who are looking to do what I did last year, take somebody's spot. This is just not going according to plan. Tony, I think you're at a crossroads, Donnie said. You know what life is all about. You profess to be a Christian, and you tell everybody that God has first place in your life. Now, when your career looks like it's teetering, we're getting a chance to see what really is in first place for you. I thought about that all day and then came back to the conversation with Donnie. You're probably right, I told him. I feel like I've been learning from you guys and growing, and I'm feeling better about my faith and thinking that I trust the Lord. I'm trying to understand what you guys have, but all of a sudden, I come to a crisis point and I begin to panic. My thoughts turn to, what am I going to do? Donnie paused and measured me squarely. All the Lord is trying to do is find out what's in first place in your life, and right now, it looks like football is. I immediately knew Donnie was right, and I felt convicted. I think that was the point at which I really began to understand what it means to be a Christian, and I began making an effort to start changing and growing as a person. It was the first time I was able to look at football as something that God was allowing me to do, not something that should define me. I couldn't take my identity from this sport. I had to consciously make sure that God was in first place. Now that I'm older and have gone through many, much more difficult crises than those 3 weeks of mono, I look back at that time as key to my maturity as a Christian. Several days later, I still wasn't better, but I had begun to simply pray that whether I sat out the entire year, came back immediately, or was cut, I would keep God first. About 2 weeks later, as we were getting ready for our first preseason game, I was finally able to start practicing again. It was one of those miracle years. I was healthy, and it seemed like every time I took the field, the ball was headed my way. We went 14-2 and won the Super Bowl over Dallas, 35-31. I led the team in interceptions and was tied for 10th in the NFL. I was one interception behind Herm Edwards, who would coach with me years later, though I think he would gladly trade that interception for being able to fish as well as I can. Despite all the good things that occurred that year, I can still look back and say that 1978 was the first season in my life in which sports weren't the most important thing to me. I finally realized that how I live on earth was just as important as my salvation. God had me here for a reason, and it wasn't just to play ball. It was then that the words of Matthew 16:26 really started to sink in. And what do you benefit if you gain the whole world but lose your own soul? Chapter 5, Leading to Lauren. After we won the Super Bowl in Miami, the summer of 1979 was much the same as the one before. I was lifting and running, hanging out with the Steelers, and growing in my faith. That fall, I arrived at camp in fantastic shape. I was healthy, too. No mono, thank goodness. I breezed through the initial cuts and reached the weekend of the biggest cut of camp. All the cuts had been made but one. The coaching staff still had to get rid of one more player in order to reach the required number. We were hanging out in Joe Green's dorm room. Donnie Shell, Mel Blunt, Franco Harris, Terry Bradshaw, Joe and I, trying to figure out what the coaches were going to do. It was apparent that the coaches were having difficulty deciding or working out a trade because it was taking longer than usual. Finally, there came a knock on the door. I looked around the room. Shell, Blunt, Harris, Bradshaw, Green, and Dungy. I stood up. "Well, it's got to be me," I said as I left the room. As it turned out, I had not been cut, but I had been traded, from the best team in football to the worst. I was headed to the San Francisco 49ers, and in spite of my attempt at humor, I was sorry to go. After doing so well in 78, I had fully expected to be with the Steelers for many years. I had even bought a house during the offseason, so this move was a shock. But this was the NFL. Trades and cuts were always a possibility. The previous year had really shaped my attitude, though. If this had happened even 1 year earlier, I probably would have been devastated. Now, however, as would happen many more times in my future, I saw it as God moving me to where He wanted me to go. In San Francisco, we went 2-14. While San Francisco was a different environment from Pittsburgh, it was no less valuable for my career development. It was Bill Walsh's first year as head coach, and he was beginning to lay the foundation for the Super Bowl teams he would eventually field there. Joe Montana was in his rookie season at quarterback, and other pieces were being added in order to build the team. Years later, I would often draw on Coach Walsh's teachings as I tried to build the Buccaneers. Even a 2-14 team wouldn't have me, though, and I was traded before the 1980 season to the New York Giants. I was traded along with Mike Hogan in exchange for Ray Rhodes and Jimmy Robinson, a trade that would soon launch several coaching careers. Within a couple of seasons, Ray and Jimmy were out of the league as players and into coaching. As for me, I lasted for most of training camp with the Giants before being released. 3 teams in 2 years. The end of the line for me as an NFL player had obviously arrived. Now I had to figure out what I wanted to do next. Giants head coach Ray Perkins spoke to me as I was leaving training camp in New York. "Tony, you're very smart and you have a good approach to the game. I think you'd make a very good coach someday." I figured that was his way of getting me out the door without too much conversation. But later I would learn that Coach Perkins just wasn't the type to make small talk. I had spent parts of summers working at various Pittsburgh businesses like Mellon Bank and Heinz, but I hadn't found anything that I loved. So I headed back to the University of Minnesota to work out and stay in shape in case another team called, volunteering as a defensive backs coach for the Golden Gophers for the rest of the 1980 season. Finally, the Denver Broncos called late in the year, but I had missed so many games by then I figured I wouldn't do anyone any good. I declined and effectively ended my playing career. Immediately after the season, Coach Perkins followed through on his earlier comments, calling to offer me a coaching position. I was very interested, and after talking with him, I figured I was destined to go to New York. In the meantime, Wellington Mara, the owner of the Giants, mentioned to his close friend Art Rooney of the Steelers that it looked as though they would be hiring a former Steeler, me, as one of their coaches. Mr. Rooney called Coach Noel, who called me. "If you're really interested in coaching, I think we can create something for you right here," he said. I accepted the offer and became a Steeler once more. In taking that job with the Steelers at the age of 25, I became the youngest coach in the NFL. The situation could have been a disaster, but the Steelers made it easy for me to break in as a coach. Even though I was younger than most of the players, and they had seen me come in just 3 years earlier not knowing anything about defense, those guys were professionals. So many of them were locked into the idea of living for Christ that it didn't matter who was coaching them. They worked hard and honored God through it because that's just what they did. Before I knew it, I was doing odd jobs, breaking down film, and essentially acting as an assistant to the head coach. Chuck Noll always reminded us that football is what you're doing now, but it's not your life's work. You've got to continue to prepare for your life's work. Occasionally, it occurred to us that he had been in football for such a long time that it certainly seemed to be his life's work, but I don't think anybody ever had the guts to say it. Chuck often preached the importance of time away from the office, and we knew it wasn't just lip service. Chuck lived out his message. He loved to cook, drive boats, and fly planes. He never wanted to just hang around the office, especially if the work was done. His philosophy was, get the work done so you can enjoy the other parts of your life. I was single at the time, so the other parts of my life in Pittsburgh did not include family, but the Steelers organization was certainly a great place for me to learn and shape a philosophy. It was Father's Day weekend of 1981, my first year coaching with the Steelers. The phone rang late on Friday night, June 19th. It was our chaplain, Hollis Half, who had told me he needed a last-minute speaker for the Father and Son breakfast at St. Stephen's Episcopal Church in Sewickley, just outside of Pittsburgh. Each year, one of the Steelers' players or coaches spoke, but this year's speaker, lineman Ted Peterson, had gotten sick. I didn't feel like getting up early. I had just walked in from an all-day, out-of-town football clinic. I think Hollis could read my mind. "I know it's a lot to ask, but we've done this every year, and they're really counting on us to have someone there. Ted's sick, and I wouldn't even ask, except..." I told Hollis I'd do it as a favor to him. The next morning, I showed up at St. Stephen's to meet the senior pastor, Dr. John Guest. I made the appropriate apologies on behalf of Ted and the Steelers, and Dr. Guest asked if he could sit with me during the meal. "I've got a bio prepared on Ted, but I'm afraid I don't know anything about you. At least if we sit together while we eat, I could put together a reasonable introduction." During breakfast, I shared with Dr. Guest what I planned to say to the group. Thanks to my mom's training, I never had been afraid to speak in public, and at that point, I was always ready to talk about my faith. Because it was an event for fathers and sons, and I didn't have any children of my own, I talked about a subject I knew something about and that most boys are interested in, athletics. In these type of settings, I often use 1 Corinthians 9, 24-27 as my starting point. In that passage, Paul talks about competing and running to win. I told the group that we always have to be sure the prize we're after is worthwhile. I explained that while the Super Bowl is a great goal, if it's all we're after, we'll be disappointed when we get there. When I finished speaking, Dr. Guest approached me again. I'm not sure how to say this, but there's a girl in my congregation here that you've really got to meet. I know this sounds strange since I've only been with you for an hour, but I think the two of you would be perfect for each other. I did my best to gently blow him off. That's interesting. Maybe, sure, we could do that sometime. Okay, thanks. As I left, Dr. Guest could tell that I wasn't taking him seriously. He called Hollis Half later to get my phone number. Tony, I know you think this is crazy, but I'm serious, he said when he called. You ought to meet this girl. I was thinking, this church has 5,000 people, and there are no single guys she can get attached to. What must she look like? Dr. Guest called me 3 or 4 more times over the next couple of weeks, asking if he could simply introduce me to this girl. That's all I want to do. I'm just so certain that you will click and this will be perfect. Meanwhile, I was not quite so certain. Maybe you could just give me her number, I suggested. I thought that would get him to quit calling me and make all this go away. I'm sorry, Tony, but she's not that tight to take kindly to you calling her directly. I really need to do it this way, to introduce you. All the while, Dr. Guest was apparently trying the same tactics with the girl he wanted me to meet, and he wasn't getting any further with her. I later learned that she was even less interested than I was. She was thinking, here's a guy who played for the Steelers and now coaches with the Steelers, and he can't get a date in Pittsburgh? What kind of nerd must he be? She was closer to the truth than I was. I was quiet and shy, and I wasn't particularly interested in dating. I was more interested in finding a woman I could marry, and I figured that day wouldn't come for a while yet. After weeks of putting Dr. Guest off, I finally agreed to meet the girl. The Steelers were leaving to begin training camp on July 20th, so I told him I'd only be free the following day, Saturday, July 18th. Dr. Guest then called her and pitched the idea that I would like to come by and meet her. She reluctantly agreed. When I got to her house and she opened the door, I was stunned. Lauren Harris was beautiful. She reminded me of the way my mom looked when I was a young boy. She had a pretty smile and a thin, athletic build. I couldn't believe she wasn't already dating someone. She was dressed conservatively, like the school teacher that she was, although at the time she was actually taking summer classes herself. Lauren was pretty reserved, at least at first, not yet knowing this man the minister had sent to her door, and I was nervous. Her parents were both there, and her dad, Leonard, was gregarious and very friendly to me right from the start. He seemed to be moving 100 miles an hour as he raced around trying to get to work. I would later learn that this was par for the course for him. Her mom, Doris, looked as if she could have been Lauren's older sister. She sat down in the kitchen with us, and we talked for a while, getting acquainted. On his way out the door, Leonard asked me to share a little football advice with Chuck Knoll, then he was gone. As Lauren and her mom and I continued to talk, I became a little more comfortable and started to relax. Lauren was so genuine. She wasn't trying to impress me, nor was she impressed that I was an NFL coach. In fact, not only was she not impressed that I was a coach with the Steelers, my job actually was a mark against me in her book. Her brothers had played football, and she didn't care for the way girls had chased them all throughout high school simply because they were athletes. We talked about her teaching. She taught 6th grade, and her involvement at her church. Right away, I knew there was a gentle, caring side to this girl. After only about 20 minutes, Lauren stood to leave.